Thanks for being with us, everyone. Interesting discussion with Robert Hastings, author of the book UFOs and Nukes. We've heard some of his stories about intrusions at American and Russian military bases, nuclear facilities. As sort of a corollary to that story, that account, is this weird mystery about cattle mutilations. And I don't know if it's related or not. We'll get, when we come back, we'll get Robert Hastings' take on that, about the proximity of cattle mutilations to some of these same bases where the UFO intrusions occurred. And we'll get to your questions as well. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Robert Hastings, author of UFOs and Nukes. Robert, one of the things that that really stood out to me after reading your book is the idea that, you know, if it had been anything else involving these nuclear missile bases, a technical glitch, a human failure, a screw up of some sort, and the news got out, it would seem like heads would roll. And yet, because it's UFOs, it goes nowhere.
It's suppressed as quickly as possible. One of the incidents we were talking about in March of 67 at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Echo Flight, all 10 missiles went down on March 16th. And the Boeing company was one of the Minuteman missile contractors. A researcher named Jim Klotz located and wrote to the man who headed up the Boeing team that investigated that. His name was Robert Kaminsky, and I have a copy of the lengthy letter Mr. Kaminsky wrote to Jim Klotz, and which he said that we could find absolutely no prosaic cause, nothing to do with mechanical issues, electrostatic issues, weather issues, nothing that caused the failure of these 10 missiles. He said the only way the failure could be duplicated is if you directly injected a charge into one of the underground cables, electrical charge, which there was no evidence of anyone having done that. What was most interesting in Mr. Kaminsky's letter was that somewhere in the course of their investigation, they got a call from the Air Force saying, suspend the investigation. We do not want a final report from you. And Kaminsky told Jim Klotz that this was unheard of. The contract, you know, the customer, the Air Force, always wanted to know why a missile system had a problem, had an issue. So Mr. Kaminsky, being rather puzzled by this request, order actually by the Air Force not to pursue the investigation, made some inquiries, called people at Malmstrom that he was in touch with, and was told that the Echo shutdown was considered a UFO event and was not to be pursued by the Air Force. I've interviewed another targeting officer named Robert Jameson, who was involved in the second full flight shutdown, that Oscar flight. We think it was on the 25th of March. In any case of 67, he said before they went out to the team to field to retarget the missiles, all of the targeting teams, including Robert Jameson's team, was told that UFOs had caused the shutdown, and they were told if they saw a UFO on the way out to the site to report it, and if a UFO appeared while they were retargeting the missile to get into the underground missile silo through what's called the personnel access hatch. And they were explicitly told that these were UFO-related shutdowns. And, you know, again, that's something that officially the Air Force will not admit even to this day.
One other question before we open the phone lines, and it deals with mutilations. I know this is not your specialty or your field, but it is related in a sense, the proximity to the bases. And a lot of times when you had these UFO intrusions at the northern tier bases, it was followed by periods of mutilations and other strange activity. There's a guy named Keith Wolverton, who was a sheriff up there in Montana, who wrote a book about it. What's your take?
Well, it's most of your listeners have probably heard about mutilations, so I won't go into what they are themselves. But, it's a worldwide phenomenon. It's been going on in Argentina and other places around the world that have large cattle populations. But I can tell you that in the 1975 cases that we opened the show with, the Northern Tier shutdowns in Montana, this period of several weeks when missiles were dropping offline, or not dropping offline, but were having problems and being visited by UFOs in October and November of 75, coincidentally or not, around Cascade County and surrounding areas within the Montana, the Malmstrom Air Force Base missile field, many mutilated cattle were found. I believe the number was over 60 of them, which were investigated by the Cascade County Sheriff's Department and Keith Wolverton and others. And one of the people I interviewed was the commander of the Malmstrom's helicopter squadron, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Pizer, and he said that Wolverton showed up at his office one day and said, you know, let's talk about these mutilations. And they started comparing notes, and it found out that you know, dozens of these things had taken place during the same general time frame that UFOs were being reported out at the missile sites. The same type of overlap occurred at F.E. Warren Air Force Base, Cheyenne, Wyoming, in the mid-70s, I think, off the top of my head, 73, 74, 75 time frame, where this large missile field area covering three states, parts of Nebraska and Colorado and Wyoming, where all the missiles were scattered, experienced a great many cattle mutilations at the same time that the UFO activity was being reported at the missile sites. So there is a definite overlap in those two cases. I also know from recent interviews I've done with ranchers up in Montana that this mutilations are going on again. They've started up about 2001 and are continuing now. And again, in the same general area, some of them where the missile sites are being deactivated. We talk about the squadron near Conrad, Montana. Those are being deactivated, but there are still mutilations occurring right around the general proximity of the missile sites up there.
And again, because it's maybe UFOs are involved, mainstream media, other folks don't take it seriously. Okay, missile cattle were mutilated, so what, you know?
You know, it's... The ranchers, if you look at the history of the mutilation phenomenon, the ranchers initially, you know, I mean, they've dealt with cattle all their life. They know what a predator kill looks like, and they know what, you know, what's going on with their animals. And in every case, they said they'd never seen anything like it. You know, the certain parts of the animal were excised, the anal area, the sex organs, hide off one side of the face. And the blood is usually drained. And a moment ago, I forgot to mention that I interviewed a ranching couple who lived outside of Great Falls who told me that on their ranch they had one of these missile sites, launch facilities. And one morning they found a mutilated steer inside the security fence surrounding this missile site. Somebody had lifted it up and mutilated it and lifted it up and dropped it inside the silo. Sort of a calling card, who knows? But it's, you know, after a while, when the law enforcement can't do anything about it, the military can't do anything about it, you know, the ranchers don't need all the headaches and the bad publicity of, you know, mutilated cattle on their ranch. They just file a report with the insurance company, get the money, and just, you know, move on.
And then it goes away. We're going to the phones. Wildcard line, Jeff in Houston, Texas. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. How you guys doing? Hey, well, I have a question. I'm a prior Air Force guy, and I've been stationed overseas and whatnot. I was just curious, listening to you guys' conversation tonight, is this just strictly considered to the just the missiles and the ICBMs, or is it also connected to, like, the Blue 109s that we have?
The what?
The Blue 109s. It's a nuclear device that can attach to any aircraft, such as the B-52 and the B-2 bombers that we can drop off.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that particular device, but I can tell you, you know, based on the declassified documents and the testimony of the people that I've interviewed over the last 35 years, you've got UFO activity at virtually every type of nuclear weapons site and facility, ranging from nuclear weapons sites to test facilities in Nevada to the laboratories in New Mexico, every type of nuclear-related situation. As far as bombers and aircraft, again, there were incidents up at Loring Air Force Base, Grand Forks, Wirt Smith back in the 70s, where objects were sighted either hovering over the nuclear weapons storage areas or over what are called the Christmas trees or the bomber alert areas where the bombers are staged, armed and ready in case of national conflict, you know, international conflict. So although I'm not familiar with any specific incident involving the device you described, it, you know, it's not out of the question, certainly.
Thanks, Jeff. So that would include nuclear subs?
I found, this is an interesting sidelight, There's very little. There's only one chapter in 31 chapters in my book where I talk about naval cases involving submarines, because the naval, the nuclear submariners that I've approached, they basically think I'm either a terrorist or a communist or something. they are just so tight-lipped. They will not give me the time of day, with a couple of exceptions. So there are reports of UFO sightings near nuclear weapons subs, nuclear submarines, rather, but I have not been able to get witnesses to go on the record about it. What I do report is at the Bangor Naval Base, it's now called Subbase Kitsap, west of Seattle. It's the basically staging area, the home base of the Pacific Submarine Fleet. There are just sightings on an ongoing basis, at least since the early 1990s, and I describe about two dozen of those that were reported in the local media or by locals at the base there, describing UFOs hovering over and flying around the Trident missile warheads, weapon storage areas, or over the sub pens themselves. So it's going on as far as the naval nuclear weapons program too, but I just can't get those guys to talk to me.
Okay, back to the wild card lines. Douglas in Yuba City, California. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you this evening?
Good.
All right. It is completely possible that they are monitoring the missile sites for the reason that you state, to give us a warning and to advise us to be pretty careful. But a thought also occurs to me that it is possible that their science might have taken them in entirely different directions, or maybe they don't have any uranium or plutonium, or maybe they're just monitoring for pure curiosity. And so the thought that follows from that is that I think we are advancing the position far more that is the reason, that they are monitoring those sites just for that one reason, that it's supposed to be some kind of warning, then we have proof for it. So I think we might be missing something if we don't more actively consider other options and focus a little less on just repeating the one answer that we don't have any proof for.
I think that's a very valid point. In my book, I'm very careful to differentiate between reports and the data as it is, as opposed to my opinion of what that data represents. So I think, as I think I said earlier tonight, you know, we are operating on a best-case basis, and we really don't know what's going on. The people at the sites don't know what's going on. Maybe a handful of people very high up know what's going on, but they're not talking to me. As far as the technology that seems to be associated with UFOs, I would say it is so far beyond nuclear power. You know, it clearly involves some sort of anti-gravity or gravity neutralization process. I really suspect that they're not here to learn about our technology. I think it's more a question of they've probably been around here for thousands of years, slowly monitoring us, and now we're at a point where we can destroy ourselves on the planet. And as I said earlier, I don't pretend to know if it's a moral impulse or the self-serving interests or a combination of the two, but I think they're really, it's a question of them sending us a signal. But who knows? I don't pretend to know.
Thank you, Douglas. That was a good point. You know, we are dealing with speculative matters here. You know, we Robert can describe the cases, and then we can just guess what it means. But thanks for the call. Also on the wild card line, Michael in Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Very good. Thank you.
Robert, I wanted to ask you, I was in the Air Force and got a chance to spend a couple weeks in Tonopah Test Range. It seems to have a pretty similar history to the Nevada Test Range that you were speaking of, and I was just wondering if you had any reported cases out that way.
Nothing leaps to mind. I know, you know, I believe we tested the stealth fighter there in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken. There were flights out of there at Tonopah. But I can't, you know, racking my brain here, I can't think of anything that I'm personally aware of involving UFO activity at Tonopah.
Thanks, Michael. East of the Rockies, John in Ohio. Hi, John. John, are you there?
Hello?
Hello, how you doing? You're on the air on Coast to Coast AM with Robert Hastings.
How's it going? I called in to talk about a sighting that I had that was very similar to the sighting the gentleman was talking about earlier. It was a cloudy night, though, and there was a big bright white light that pulsated spun with flashing blue and red lights above it. And it lasted for about 20 to 30 seconds and then just disappeared. And when I Googled the area, it was right above an old Nike missile site in western PA. And supposedly decommissioned in the 70s, but when I went up there a couple weeks later, there was a lot of activity. The site seemed really strange.
You mean military activity?
Well, there was, as soon as we drove up the dead-end road, an SUV came down to the gate to basically see what we were doing. It was all barbed wired and locked up, and they had a backhoe, like, knocking down an old building. And whenever I looked at the site online, the images were all old. All the Google images were from 20 years ago.
Well, interesting story. As I travel the country on the college lecture circuit, everywhere I go, almost any given audience, I meet people who have seen UFOs in one capacity or another, in one type of situation or another, and 99% of those never hit the media. I mean, they're not covered in any fashion, and yet they're going on an ongoing basis.
John, thanks for the call. Try to get one more in before the break. West of the Rockies, Adam in Boise. Good morning, Adam.
Yeah, Robert, last time you were on Coast to Coast, you hinted that you had the desire to possibly do a Dassel Press Club event, kind of like the one Leslie Kane did last year that kind of penetrated the mainstream media. And I was just wondering, do you still see something like that happening? And if so, what would it take to put something like that together? Thank you.
Good question. I am still hoping to have a dozen, maybe 20 of my ex-military sources speak at the National Press Club in Washington at some point, for one reason or another. That's been very slow going in terms of getting it organized. It's still a goal. Hopefully I can do it sometime in the next year or two. I'm somewhat discouraged in that there have been similar press conferences in the past. Bob Salas, who's one of the former missile launch officers who was involved in the Oscar flight shutdown at Malmstrom in 67. He and several other quite credible people spoke on two occasions, actually, at the National Press Club. And even though they were well attended and many, many members of the media there, the stories just never took off. It's like too dangerous to touch, I think. I don't know what it's going to take to get CBS or CNN or, the Washington Post to cover this in a serious fashion, but it's worth a try, and I do hope to do that in the next year or so.
Thanks for the call, Adam. Isn't part of the problem that it gets mixed up with a lot of other stuff? I mean, you had Mr. Salas there in another group, and some of the guys were pretty credible, the witnesses, and some of them, they take what we'll call leaps based on the information that's available.
That's absolutely correct. And so if I'm going to do this, it's going to be strictly former missileers, as the missile men call themselves, or missile guards. So we'll have an exclusive group, and all of them are quite credible, and maybe that will make a difference.
You said you're having problems with it, meaning financing it?
Just I just have too many projects going on at any given time, and it's just something that I had hoped to get going by 6 months ago, and it's still sort of on a back burner. But if anyone out there would like to assist me, anyone with some national stature, George, you being one person, to help me get this thing organized, then I'm open to all credible, assistance.
Man, if you're relying on me to help you organize something, you're in big trouble. Any plans for a follow-up book?
I'll
tell you what, hold that thought. We're going to take a break right now as we go into Jimi Hendrix, and we'll come back with our last segment with Robert Hastings. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. The subject, UFOs and nukes, extraordinary encounters at nuclear weapons sites. The author, Robert Hastings, is our guest. As soon as we come back, we'll go to the phone lines. We're in the home stretch, and we'll get to as many of your calls as we can. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for staying up late with us, everyone. Robert Hastings is the guest. Robert, is there a follow-up book in the works?
I'm sure there will be at some point. Nothing planned for the immediate future. It took me 35 years to research and 7 years to write this one, and so I'm just going to let it stay out there for a while. We should mention the only place that book is available is from my website, ufohastings.com, And I did want to interject something real quickly here. We mentioned briefly Bentwaters earlier on. Most of your listeners will know what that is. In any case, there was UFO activity, quite a bit of it, in December of 1980 at RAF Bentwaters in England. And the people who are involved in that UFO activity are getting together a reunion for the summer of 2010. They want people who were involved in any of those incidents over the period of a week between Christmas and New Year's 1980 to contact them. If I may just give an address here, the website is www.backtobentwaters.blogspot.com. It's backtobentwaters.blogspot.com. They also have an email address, which is bentwaters@hotmail.co.uk. Bentwaters@hotmail.co.uk, and maybe Coast to Coast can put that up for people to read. But John Burroughs, who was one of the air policemen who actually saw this object in the woods, Rendlesham Forest, that landed near the, by the way, Bentwaters weapons storage area, which had tactical nuclear weapons in it. I've interviewed several people who were at the weapons storage area, and they described UFO quite near it. Charles Halt, who is a deputy base commander, reports seeing one of the UFOs sending down beams of light, and at the same time hearing on the radio that some of the beams were falling either near or into the weapons storage area. So here again, we have a nuclear weapons related case. But in any event, this group is getting together a reunion in England next summer, and they want as many people who are involved in those incidents to contact them and hopefully attend and share information.
Okay, back to the phones. Wildcard line, Eric in Indiana. Good morning, Eric.
Yeah, George, thanks for taking my call. I just basically had a quick comment more than anything for Robert. Growing up as a kid in Montana, actually right outside of Great Falls in Stockett, Montana, Malmstrom Air Force Base was maybe 10, 15 minutes away. But what I wanted you to touch on, you already had, about the cattle mutilations. And, you know, as a kid in the 80s, I thought every single time that one of my friends told me that there was cattle mutilations, that these cows were turning up, as you said, blood completely drained out of the body, cauterized, et cetera, that they were just trying to scare me. But it was a very real thing as a kid growing up in the 80s to be scared of cattle mutilations in Montana.
It's, as I said, it's going on. It comes and goes. I know I live in Albuquerque, and I know up in Taos, New Mexico, there have been reports in the last two or three years. In fact, just by sheer dumb luck, perhaps we'll call it, I myself stumbled on a mutilated cow on March 18th of 2007, and I was quite shocked. But it's going on. It's going on in Argentina. It's going on all over the world. So, yeah, it's not a fantasy. It's not predators. It's not satanic cultists. And as I mentioned, there are these quite clear cases at Malmstrom and F.E. Warren where you have UFO activity occurring simultaneously. At the same time, mutilated cows are being found all over the landscape.
And you shouldn't feel bad, Eric. It is spooky and hard to explain. Thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Marie in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Hello. I just wanted to say sometimes the missiles are actually shot at UFOs. I have seen films that I was not supposed to see, gotten by someone who was not supposed to have gotten them. And I have seen these things going on where you would see from high in space, probably from some kind of satellite, perhaps the Hubble, you would see UFOs, and then you would see the streak flying up at it from the Earth. And at the very last second, the UFO would quickly jump to either the right or the left and avoid this. I was not supposed to have seen them. The person who got them was not supposed to have gotten them. I will not share who this was or where this was on the air. However, I will share this all with you and your guests if you are interested off air.
Please email me. I'm aware of one case, a video taken from one of the shuttle missions of something apparently flying along next to the shuttle at a distance and a streak of light coming apparently from the ground up toward it, and the object moves off. That's been that particular incident has been aired, broadcast now for 15 years or more. But if you are aware of other cases.
Okay. Could I say I don't have a computer in my residence right now? I'm too sick to leave my residence. Could I leave off air? Could I leave the names of the people involved?
That's up to George Knapp, rather.
Marie, we'll ask our producer, Gina, to talk to you off the air. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And we'll see if we can track that down. West of the Rockies, Mike in Utah. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, George. Good show tonight. I got two quick stories for you, a green fireball and my one and only UFO. I'm a truck driver, and I left Vegas tonight. I saw a green streak fireball come in just as I got up past Apex and the 95 exit. It came in at a low angle, and it started breaking up, so I'm pretty sure it was just a meteorite. So just coincidentally, but I went in. Now, my one and only UFO, about 4 years ago, I was in the high mountain passes of Utah looking south, and I saw a red light going at a high rate of speed across the horizon, southern horizon, and made a course correction and came directly towards me and made a complete dead stop, and then it started up in a zigzag pattern, complete dead stop, started up real fast again, came almost over me and did some real tight circles, went back south, stopped, and came back over me again. And I thought somebody was trying to put a geosynchronous satellite in orbit, and I talked to my son David, who happens to be an astrophysicist and an astronomer, and he says, we don't carry the kind of fuel on board to do the maneuvers I described. So to me, that's my one and only UFO, and I don't know what they were trying to do, but I got cold and watched it still doing circles when I left it. So I thought I'd leave you guys.
Thanks for that. A number of my military witnesses have described zigzag maneuvers over missile sites and out at sea during the hydrogen bomb tests. Sailors have reported UFOs hovering near ships that were involved in the tests and then racing away doing zigzags. You know, there's no logical reason for a craft to do a zigzag path like that to leave a vicinity, any given vicinity. So to me, it's more like an attention-getting maneuver to say, you know, look at us, we're here. And I've always thought that that was something more than just, you know, a normal navigational maneuver.
Like a performance.
Right, exactly.
Thanks, Mike. We're going to our first-time caller line, David in Kentucky. Good morning, David.
Morning.
What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. What's on your mind?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I got a question. I was just wondering, could it be that, like, I know we have a lot of solar systems in our universe and stuff, and maybe that their star is about to burn out, that they're testing our atmosphere and stuff to see if they can live here, and also checking out our weapons capability?
Well, here's my read on that. If you look at the history of occupant sightings, in other words, cases where UFOs have landed and critters of one description or another get out and walk around. There was a very famous series of sightings like that in France in the fall of 1954. But things like that have taken place all over the world in the last 60 years. If you look at the beings that are being described, it's clear, if you accept the reports as credible, that we're dealing with a number of races. You've got tall UFO occupants, short ones. You've got some that look human, some that are covered with hair. You have a whole range of physical appearances, different facial features, skin color, and so on. My opinion is that this planet is being visited by multiple races from different planets. And if indeed that is the case, then one would assume that there would be different agendas. Some may be explorers, some may be keeping an eye on our nuclear weapons. I am an optimist, and I'm hoping that none of them are here to take us over or invade the planet, but who knows? And the other thing, and I touched on this early on, you know, for a good century, The theory that physicists held universally was that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, and therefore the thinking is that even if there are other worlds out there, they can't possibly travel from their world to here because it would take way too long. But in just the last few years, there's a whole new series of theories being proposed by physicists involving hyperspace, higher dimensional space. Long story short, if that exists, that allows faster than light travel, in which case, if other races in our galaxy figure this out 100 years or 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years before humans, they're probably getting around the galaxy quite easily. And so I don't think you can say the aliens are here to do this, that, or the other, because we're probably dealing with a number of different races who probably don't all have the same agenda.
But you could say that if someone was here to do us harm, they could have done that already.
Exactly.
Wildcard line, John in Long Beach. Good morning, John.
Yes, thank you. This is regards the contact story. I don't know if you're familiar with this. Gina's a compatriot from West Virginia like me. In Parkersburg, West Virginia, in 1967, which is roughly around the same time that people were seeing the allegedly seeing the beings in Point Pleasant, you know, that was the Mothman whole thing. A guy named Woodrow Derenberger, I don't know if you've ever heard this story. You could look it up. Said that he got stopped on the highway and flagged down by some guy or something. I forget all the details, but he had a conversation with the guy that said he was from a different planet and that he was an alien and all that. And he seemed to be crazy. Well, he wasn't a guy that people thought was a fruitcake. You know what I mean? He was a pretty well-respected man in the community. And it became kind of a cause celeb for a while. And I just didn't know if you were familiar with that particular thing, that story.
I'm not, my email address is at my website, ufohastings.com. If you'll write to me with the particulars, I'd be happy to investigate it.
Okay, thank you, John. Wildcard line, Dave in California. Good morning, Dave.
Hi, I'm calling because I had a couple questions for the guests.
Okay.
My first one was, what do you think about the political implications of what would happen to the officials if they disclosed under the current laws? And what do you think about Congress lifting them in the future?
If I understand your questions as to what the government's motivation is for keeping things secret, am I on the right track? Is that what you're asking?
As far as the current laws that prevent NASA and other government officials about talking about things, do you think they'll be lifted soon with all the pressure on them from organizations?
There is a former CIA employee named Victor Marchetti, and in 1975 he wrote the best-selling book, The CIA and Cult of Intelligence, and he basically was exposing CIA abuses of American law and other types of basically moral behavior. In any case, it was a national bestseller. The CIA tried to censor it. And in 1979, the same Victor Marchetti wrote an article in a magazine called Second Look. And the article was titled, How the CIA Views the UFO Phenomenon. What Marchetti said was, for example, he was fairly high up. He was administrative assistant to the then director of CIA, Richard Helms. In any case, he said that there were rumors at CIA about crashed UFOs and the bodies of little men being recovered, but he said that in his view, based on his work as a CIA intelligence analyst, even if there was no threat from the aliens, there would be no reason why any government on Earth would willingly announce that there was alien visitation, because there could be massive upheaval to political systems, to economic systems, to religious worldviews. It was just like opening a can of worms. You do not, even if there's no hostile intent, you just let things unfold or let the next administration deal with the problem. You keep it as quiet as possible, as long as possible. And I think there is some truth to that. I think Marchetti's perceptions are pretty astute, in my view. So I don't predict, I never predict as to how this is all going to break wide open. I just know that inevitably it will have to. It may involve an action on the part of whoever's in the UFOs themselves suddenly, you know, doing something that leaves no doubt in anybody's mind that they're here.
Thanks, Dave. And yet around the world, we see disclosures of sorts, files being released to Britain, France, and other countries.
that may be a, you know, a low-level effort to, you know, get a little bit of the truth out. Like you said earlier, it may well be that people in the Pentagon don't necessarily like my approach to things, but ultimately they realize that what I'm doing is sort of easing the path for an ultimate announcement, me and every other person who's attempting to get the facts out. So it, that may be what's going on. It's just I just don't get too excited because, you know, everybody's been predicting this year or next year is going to be the big announcement. You know, it'll happen when it happens, and I don't hold my breath.
You always ask the question of, is there a storehouse of this kind of information somewhere, in particular film? In your book, of course, you mentioned the Big Sur incident, and I guess someone came in, and there was actually film recorded of this incident, but someone came in and snipped it and took it away. And you got to wonder, where the heck is it?
There is a component of the CIA called NPIC, the National Photo Interpretation Center, and it actually was the group that did the analysis on the Cuban missiles, the Russian missiles in Cuba, and sent the film to Kennedy and did a briefing for him and so on. Todd Zuckel, the UFO researcher I mentioned earlier, told me a funny story. He showed up unannounced at the doorstep of Arthur Lundell, who was the founder of NPIC, and kind of muscled his way in the door, basically stuck his foot in the door and started asking him questions about UFOs. And Lundell, you know, was trying to get rid of him, didn't want to talk to him. Todd said before he was, in effect, evicted from the house, he looked over in a hallway or a study, and he saw a bookcase filled with UFO-related books on Art Lundell's bookcase, which doesn't prove anything, but I thought was kind of a humorous story.
You mentioned earlier about the prospect of hearings, you know, and I know there were those two news conferences held at the National Press Club and different groups in the UFO community pushing for hearings. Is that the ultimate goal? I mean, do you think that that would be a step in the right direction?
I think it would be a step in the right direction. I have never assumed that anything I'm doing or anything that my sources could say would be the you know, create the tipping point to bring this all out in the open. I just don't... I'm just not that optimistic that any one person or even 100 witnesses who said, you know, I was there when the missiles were shut down by the UFO are going to get the attention of the press or, you know, world governments. It would be nice, and it's a step in the right direction, but again, I just don't make predictions about how this thing's going to break or what's required to make it break.
I always try to figure out what politician gets in front of that parade. You know, what politician figures, yeah, this is going to be good for my political future.
Exactly. But yeah, I think that speaks volumes, what you just said. You know, what have they got to gain? You know, and most of them aren't going to touch this subject with a 10-foot pole.
You've been around this topic for a long time. You know most of the major researchers and organizations. Describe for, we have just a minute or so left, the treatment that you've had at the hands of the UFO community, because, you know, there's some great people in there, well-meaning, and then there's some absolute crazy people.
Yep. And I don't think I want to end this on a negative note, but yeah,
no.
There are some people that I've wrestled with recently who have mentioned my research in the same breath that they say something ludicrous, and I've written a couple of nasty letters, which are now online. But I think the QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, and the people there, Jerry Clark, Mark Rodiger, and others, Kevin Randall, very solid people. They have my great respect. Someone who just passed away, Dick Hall. Richard Hall was a pioneer and a giant. He wrote a book called The UFO Evidence, and I think in 1960, in any case, just, you know, solid, solid research. And it seems like nowadays anybody with a mouse and a keyboard gets online and talks about nonsense and has done no research whatsoever. I miss the good old days.
Robert Hastings, thanks very much. Fascinating book, UFOs and Nukes. Hope you'll come back and join us, and I hope some folks out there listening who might have information on similar incidents will give us a call or drop us an email. Thank you, everyone. I'll be back next month with more Coast to Coast AM. Have a good one.